Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. I am Cy Kellett, your host, as happy as can be because Chris Check, our president, is here. Joe Heschmeyer, apologist extraordinaire, is here. Everybody's wearing flannel because it's flannel panel today, and that flannel panel means we get together and we just talk about the news of the world from a Catholic perspective. We were talking when we went to the break about the Alabama Supreme Court decision on embryos, calling embryos children. And Joe, I said I was going to come back and ask, kind of move into part B of that conversation, because the outrage that I heard on the TV news about the fact that the Supreme Court, the head of the Supreme Court, what do you call him? The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama quoted the Bible in this decision. And this was taken to be outrageous. I don't know. Is that terribly uncommon?
It's not terribly uncommon, and it's not outrageous. And in fact, the court quotes from the Bible in the way, like the U.S. Supreme Court does this in both good decisions and bad, with some regularity for good reason, because you're trying to show the history of an idea. So I guess I'd maybe start by saying the people freaking out about this, it would be a good idea if they read books besides A Handmaid's Tale, so they stop thinking that everything that happens is A Handmaid's Tale. Like the closest thing that happens to A Handmaid's Tale.
That's a beautiful point, Joe. Yeah.
Is the IVF. Because if you remember in Handmaid's Tale, the whole idea is you have the man and woman, and then there's another woman who's being used as a vessel to produce babies. Right. That's what actually goes on in a lot of IVF.
Right.
But leave that aside. This is not A Handmaid's Tale because they quote the Bible. In context, the Supreme Court is making the point that language about the sanctity of life is actually pretty new. You know, if you read old documents, you're not going to find this phrase about the sanctity of life. But then it says, but the principle itself, that human life is fundamentally distinct from other forms of life and cannot be taken intentionally without justification, has deep roots that reach back to the creation of man in the image of God. And then it quotes Genesis, and then it quotes several different commentaries that talk about how this idea of man being made in the image of God has always been tied in the Western understanding of the distinctiveness of what makes murder wrong. That if, you know, to put it a different way, if you don't think there's an important moral distinction between man and an animal, then it's very hard to explain why you would be okay with leather or meat eating or anything like this and not okay with murder and cannibalism. Like, what is the principled distinction that you're okay with one and not the other? And some people will say there is no principled distinction, meat is murder, and they'll kind of go off to one extreme. But the vast majority of people recognize there's a difference between eating a cheeseburger and eating your friend. And you'd have to be kind of insane not to realize that distinction. And that at the heart of that distinction is that your friend has a special human dignity. In fact, even a person you don't know, you wouldn't be okay eating them in a burger. And it has to do with the idea that your neighbor, your human neighbor, is made in the image of God. Now, you don't have to believe in Christianity to say there's some kind of special uniqueness to humans that make them different than other creatures and therefore make it's not okay to simply murder them. But if we're given an honest intellectual history of where this idea is coming from in Western jurisprudence, well, it's coming in no small part from a biblical worldview.
I see. So you're tracing the history of ideas. That is quite common, actually, in the legislation and jurisprudence of this country. Let me just ask you if either of you knows an answer to a technical question, because I thought that the media was impressively incurious about this, just refused to ask this question. It seems to me that this decision has to do with freezing embryos, not about implanting embryos in a mother's womb. That it didn't seem to me that technically it was at all. Now, I must say, I accept the church's teaching and the logic of the idea that IVF is immoral. Even if you get a beautiful, healthy baby out of it, that's a good result. But there's lots of times we get a good result from an immoral action. You know, you get to work faster if you drive 100 miles an hour, just to give a banal example.
So you should try that, Si.
I think I haven't. So the IVF is, I'm not challenging the immorality of IVF, but I am asking a technical question about what the Alabama Supreme Court did. It doesn't seem to me that they said you can't have IVF.
No, they didn't.
It seems to me they said you can't freeze human beings, their children.
I actually don't even know that they went that far. What they, Joe, you may know what the court, the case came up because some embryos were damaged by some carelessness in a laboratory. And then,
what? How does that? That doesn't seem. Oops. Well, that's. How deep has the disrespect for human life gone that you're just like, oh shoot?
I actually think this is exactly what happened. They were knocked off a table or something like
Are
that.
Are you kidding me?
You know, so there were some, and then the parents had some claim against the laboratory or something like that. But your point about IVF, I think, is one that we should underscore here. The immorality of IVF derives, to be sure, in part from the fact that in the process, human beings are created and killed. But it is the offense against the marital embrace. Where it locates its first immorality.
Yeah, there's two immoralities involved.
Yes.
One, I would suggest, is graver than the other, and that is the destruction of innocent human life. But I don't know how you measure the gravity. It just is, on an emotional level, that seems much graver. But so there's two immoralities here. It seems to me that you could say to people, you just can't mistreat the embryos that you create. I mean, the state of Alabama could. I'm not saying I want to. Do you see my question, Joe?
Well,
I'm
fearful that some people might say, okay, well, I'm for IVF as long as no embryos get destroyed in the process. Now, I think...
I think it's an impossible position. I've known Protestants who've taken exactly this view.
But wait, you're right. What about this, though? What if a person were to say, I believe it should be illegal to harm an embryonic human being. I don't believe it should be illegal to use IVF. Do you see what I'm saying? There's a. I'm not talking on the moral level, talking on the legal level.
If you say that, you're holding two opposing realities.
Not necessarily, because we say contraception is immoral, but we don't say that at least certain types of contraception, you know, that should all be illegal. We should teach people that it's immoral, but that doesn't mean it has to be illegal.
It's a perfectly reasonable position. I think the issue, which I think both sides realize, is if you treat unborn children like children, IVF becomes functionally impossible.
It does.
Because you don't leave them in freezers. So right now, I mean, the way IVF is done is you don't just fertilize one egg. Because the science isn't good enough. And because the woman's body won't accept every fertilized egg. And so you fertilize a lot of eggs. You have a lot of living human beings. And unless you want a case like, you know, the so-called Octomom case, where a woman gets pregnant with all eight and doesn't do what they call a selective
abortion,
reduction, where they murder some of your children, then you're going to either have a lot of kids or... you're going to have kids that you leave in a freezer. Like those are just, you know, you could do a case by case IVF where you go through the entire IVF process, but it's expensive and it's unpleasant and it's not that reliable.
Yeah.
And so as a result, that's not how things are actually done. So yes, you could conceivably have a world where you say you can fertilize one egg. You can play God with one child at a time. But you can't just kill them or throw them away.
Yeah, you're still creating a child in a dish,
which is not where children are
supposed to be created.
No, I agree with that.
They're supposed to be created in the context of a cooperative act that God has ordained between two married persons.
But we always
say, in every case,
point
is there's plenty of deviations from that aren't illegal.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You can't have every, like you cannot have a human society in which every immoral act is illegal.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. So it's possible you could have in theory a legal form of IVF that in Alabama,
where a child doesn't get hurt.
Yeah, but practically that's impossible in the laboratory.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Well, I think
we're going to find that out pretty quickly here, because you know what Cy said is right. The Supreme Court in Alabama did not say IVF is illegal. It just said there is a wrongful death of a minor act in Alabama, that if you lead to the death of a kid, the parents can bring a court action against you for killing their kid. And they have always held that that includes an unborn child. So if you were to attack a pregnant woman, kill her child, she can sue you for that, right, for the wrongful death of her child. And so then the question is, well, does this apply to extra uterine unborn children, children in a dish somewhere?
Right.
And there's no principled legal, philosophical, logical, or moral reason to treat it any different. Like if the child in
is
a living child who's legally protected from murder, well, the child outside of the womb in the same state of development is also legally protected from murder. And no one getting upset about this seems to be answering that argument. They just seem to be making variations of, but if we follow logic, that'll be inconvenient for the IVF industry. And it's like, well, okay, maybe they should not be doing barbaric things to children.
Yeah, this is one of those classic, just because we can do it, should we?
Well, but also it's more than 50 years of being educated by television and newspapers and anywhere where there was the voice of abortion could be promulgated, that the child is not worth worrying about. I mean, we've had a profound catechesis in disrespecting the unborn.
Yeah,
and this is the consequence of it.
I want to add some fuel to this fire, if I may. Presidential candidate, former president Donald Trump, said, like the overwhelming majority of Americans, including the vast majority of Republicans, conservative Christians, and pro-life Americans, I strongly support the availability of IVF for couples who are trying to have a precious baby. He declared this the true pro-life position, and he called upon Congress to quickly find an immediate solution to preserve the availability of IVF in Alabama. So not only did he come out swinging in support of IVF and against the Alabama Supreme Court ruling, he's calling on the federal government to intervene to stop pro-life judicial rulings at the state level.
Which is bizarre.
Well, we know what this is the consequence of.
Wait, what?
Appomattox.
Oh, good Lord.
This all goes back to Appomattox.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, the National Republican Senatorial Committee likewise sent out a memo to candidates telling them to support their support for IVF because it was a political issue. And so this is the depressing thing. You know, it used to be you could kind of paint it as there was a pro-life side and a pro-choice side.
No, not anymore.
And on this issue in particular, both sides are in a race to see how abhorrant they can be on the issue.
But did it leave you feeling, I'm not just in the minority on this, I'm in the minority of the minority?
But you know what? That's the way it was with the pro-life movement back in the early 70s.
Good point.
And the Catholic Church was the sole voice, and she remains the sole voice that provides the fullness of the truth. And by the way, the very clear explanation, it's not a morally complex matter. As a number of people in Alabama, I don't know how many, and some in elected officials and some appointed judges, are having to, in their quiet moments at 3 a.m, say, oh, well, yes, if this, then this.
Yeah.
There's no other way.
It's actually not a complex moral issue.
It isn't.
It's one of those ones where it's not complex. It's the working through the emotions to accept the truth of it is complex.
Well, and this
I'm complex. The issue's not complex.
Inconvenient truth to steal a phrase.
And this is why, for example, you see Trump, who has backpedaled on his stronger pro-life position, saying things like, well, we need to pick when we're going to permit abortion, 15 weeks or, you know, whatever it is.
Sure. Yeah, the truth is, I mean, he's a politician. They're all I'm very cynical about politicians, but I was impressed with how fast they were at at abandoning any moral sense and getting to a microphone and saying, I'm on the side, I'm against these babies.
Well, to this point, I've actually thought about this. If I were an elected official, I would struggle to find a way to represent my belief and the church's belief in the current conversation and be heard and felt like I was being heard. I guess the simplest thing that you could say is, well, of course, an embryo is a person and you can't create extra ones to kill them, right? And kill some of them and not kill, yeah, because that's, but yeah, so IVF for that reason is immoral. Now, there are other reasons why, but I just don't think people are equipped to even listen to that level. No,
they don't want to hear that. It's not a hard argument. Like you said before, it's a very simple. A distinct living human organism has moral and legal standing, and we shouldn't kill them without justification. That is a very simple position. That is just don't murder. Yeah. You don't need to be Christian to understand that. You don't need to be a biologist to understand that.
No.
You just have to have some really basic common sense. And then the question becomes, is the child created through IVF in that category or not? Because if not, then what is it? It's clearly not part of the mother's body or part of the father's body. It's living outside the body.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous to say, I mean, and you can implant it, by the way, in another woman's body. And so to say it's part of the woman's body, which woman? The woman who's the biological mother, the woman
not.
Who the child's right. implanted in? It like what woman's body are we allegedly trying to control here?
No.
The child's not in the body of anybody.
And it's
a distinct living body.
And everybody, I think now there's a kind of moral sense in the world that we accept the basic precept that you should do unto others as you would want done unto you. And you would not want to be frozen in nitrogen. You just wouldn't. I mean, no. I don't think it's a hard moral argument, but it is a hard one to work through. The implications mean that lots of people don't get what they want, and what they want is good. It's not bad. It's a good thing. They want.
It's an area where I think the church has a tremendous opportunity. Like Chris was saying, you know, you go back to the 1970s, Christianity Today, you know, the kind of flagship evangelical news or magazine, was pro-choice.
Yeah.
And evangelicals across the board, the Southern Baptist Conference included, were pretty much fine with abortion. And the Catholic Church played this really pivotal role in staking out a morally coherent, unpopular position at a time when we didn't have a lot of friends, including within Christianity, on that. Eventually, people like, you know, Francis Schaeffer showed up. And there's kind of a long, interesting story, too.
Yeah. Well, you know who has...
But the church was kind of taking that prophetic role, and I think we have the opportunity to do that here as well.
And you know who gives me great hope in this regard is Pope Francis, who could not be clearer about this. I mean, uses language that is stunningly clear in a country where apparently Catholics now go to wizards. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Flannel Panel, the news of the world from a Catholic perspective on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz, tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Let's mix up our stories a little bit. I'm going to go to a story about China in a few minutes, quite serious a story about China and the future of the world in a few minutes. But I want to get to this story by an author named Jerry Newcomb, and I believe it was written for Real Clear Religion. Because sometimes, you know, Real Clear Religion is an aggregator, but I think this is an article that was written for their website. And the question that in the headline, and this is what the article is about, do manners matter anymore? So I'm going to start with this question for the two of you. And as you get older, you become less impressed with the manners of young people. And you go, and you say to yourself, you have to actually ask yourself, is it because I'm becoming old and they just don't do things the way it was done when I was young? which seems likely, or is it that manners are actually fading? And which also actually seems likely to me. So, Joe, you're the youngest person on this panel by far. Are manners getting worse, or am I just getting old?
Yes, both of those things. But there, I think I want to add a third option, which is that manners are constantly changing.
Yes.
But that usually when people use manners, they mean the social conventions of the older generation.
What do you mean? So, when they use the word manners or when they...
Yeah, when they use the word, like what we usually think of as manners are the things that people of the established kind of generation expect to be done.
Oh.
And so as those people very belatedly take their exit and cede the, you know, the running of things to the next generation.
Right.
I think there is in virtually every era a sense of a moral decline. And I think a lot of what you're seeing isn't a moral decline, but a moral shift.
Okay.
You see the difference there?
Right, yes. Like I'll give you an example of that, if I may.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I realized that when I said thank you to a young person when I was getting my McFlurry, then the young person would respond, no problem.
Yeah.
And I thought, I didn't think it was a problem. I'm just saying thank you. Like the proper response to that is you're welcome. And I believe it was Jimmy Akin pointed out to me, that's not rudeness on the part of that young person. That's a change in the way people respond to the word.
That's a great example. And in fact, you're welcome makes it sound like you're acknowledging that it was an imposition. And no problem, you're actually downplaying that there was even anything to be thankful for.
Yeah.
And so it's strangely more deferential. Okay. So there's all sorts of things like that. So that's one shift. The other thing is you do have a movement away from Christianity. So as you have this generational shift that's going on in every generation, where the way you speak and act is going to be different than the older generation, and older people who feel out of touch with this find this alienating and off-putting, you also have a very legitimate claim that, and this new set of morals isn't rooted in Christianity. So for instance, making sure you're respecting another person's preferred pronouns is not something the older generation puts a very high premium on, and the younger generation does. There's a moral shift there that's also a shift in the relationship to Christianity. And I think that's something worth kind of noticing. But then maybe a third thing I'd add here is the younger generation, and I'm speaking in like huge generalities with all of this, obviously, tends to put a big premium on power dynamics, sometimes to an obsessive kind of degree. And so sometimes that can be like a really weird, unhealthy focus. But one thing it does mean is there's less tolerance for things like racist and sexist jokes, where those things would be viewed as a form of rudeness to a younger crowd.
Right.
And so they're looking at older people saying, no, you're actually being very rude. Like you were very insulting to the waitress who doesn't have the same power you have, or, you know, you told an off-color joke in this company context, or whatever. And so they would say the older generation is actually much ruder.
Oh.
And in both cases, it's you're operating with kind of a different moral framework, and each side is not meeting up with the moral framework that you've grown accustomed to.
But now let me ask you about things that aren't just shifts in the way that you express manners, you know, because that's very interesting what you just said. That's actually quite helpful to me. But there are some things that are not just a shift in you know, the meaning of things.
Yeah.
But they always mean something good or bad. You know, like well, I'm struggling for something at the moment, but
senior moment,
weaving in and out of traffic, where you're endangering other people. That's not a morally neutral thing. That's not if there's more of that, that just means we've changed the meaning of driving. No, that's bad. Yeah. You shouldn't do that.
Right.
Or I must say I'm struggling for examples of that, but. It does seem to me that there's a greater coarseness, but I'm even loath to say that given what you just said, because some of the things that we would have said as jokes when I was a teenager would get you expelled from school now.
And it would shock your
they would shock the sensibilities of my peers.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So there's a whole bunch of words people are more okay with now that older people weren't okay with.
Right.
And a whole bunch of words that they're not okay with that older people were okay with. And I think if you were to draw a through line, any word that looks like it might be picking on someone, you know, so-called punching down.
Yeah.
Is going to be a word that's demonized and it is just kind of verboten. Whereas a word that is just historically considered rude or offensive or vulgar, if there's not a power dynamic behind it that explains why it's wrong, people are more or less okay with it.
All right, but I haven't gotten to the basic thing, which is, are we becoming a bad-mannered society? And so I want to put that, I'll put that to you, Chris, and to Joe. I have found what you've said very helpful so far, though, Joe. So, but we'll find out. Are we becoming a bad-mannered society, and what does that mean? Right after this on Catholic Answers Live. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns to the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. Join special guests Scott and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and an all-star lineup of speakers September 26th through 29th. Spend time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and our special guests right here in beautiful San Diego. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Anyway, I'm here with the flannel panel, Joe Heschmeyer, Chris Check, and me, your host, Cy Kellett. And the article we're talking about right now is Do Manners Matter Anymore? From Real Clear Religion. And I'm interested in the article in part because I don't know how to gauge my reaction sometimes. Is it just you kind of age out? After a certain point, you're older than the people who are around you in the grocery store or whatnot, and you're just a grumpy old man. In other words,
yeah, so
are manners declining? Chris,
Joe used a lot of sociological jargon to try to justify.
I didn't think that they did that.
Well, punching down, and I mean, power relationship.
Oh, that was very jargony. You sounded like Margaret Mead on that one.
But really,
don't punch gorillas.
Really was transparent that he was just trying to justify the lousy behavior of his age group.
You're sounding like an old man now.
I'm not even sure. Do I fall in the younger generation in this?
To us, you do.
I turned 39 2 days ago.
I gotta say, up to this point, I kind of had more esteem and respect. So I think that a couple of things. When we hear anything about a decline of some kind of or some kind of social decline, we have to think okay, is this something that, in fact, our perception of it is exacerbated by social media, for example? So we're constantly being texted or shared with, look at this jerk on the airplane, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
But
right.
but I actually don't know if the incidences of jerks on airplanes has increased or not.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Now, there probably is a flight attendant who could tell us the answer to that question. I suspect it probably has gone up a little bit. I suspect it probably...
Well, as the size of the seats got smaller, probably. Well, yes, but it's like, because I could give you an analogy, which is here in California, people are constantly posting videos of sharks swimming around people and all that. Well, we didn't have that before because we didn't have these drones.
The people taking
we didn't
the
have people with cameras in their pockets all
yeah.
the time. So there's not
there's,
more
there's
sharks.
There's a famous example of that with sharks, 2001, in the summer. It was a slow news cycle. And Fox News declared it Summer of the Shark and just obsessively reported on every shark sighting, even though shark attacks were actually down that year.
Sure.
They just focused on them more and made people worry about sharks.
Yeah.
So
it's called the news business, Joe. It's called the news business. How do you think we got the war with Spain?
That's a good point. Sharks.
Well, it didn't have anything to do with sharks, but
they might have sunk the ship there in 1897. Who
yeah,
knows?
I think it was sharks. Oh, so I don't know what you're saying, Chris.
I suspect there is something of an increase, but I also suspect that our perception of it is exacerbated by little videos that people send us.
Right.
In my own experience, I believe that there is an increase in selfish and lazy behavior. You described the person weaving in and out of traffic. But
does nobody use their turn signal anymore either? I'm sorry about this. I feel like they're constantly trying to trick me. I feel like these youngsters are constantly trying to trick me. It's like, well, just use the turn signal. I'll know what you're about to do.
Yeah.
I know. That's very old man-ish.
But, you know.
This is becoming increasingly just like, oh, you got some rocking chairs.
Oh, wait a
minute. The kids today, they're going so fast in their cars.
Get off
your
my
reaction
lawn.
Time is just slowing down, guys.
Someone who's younger than all three of us, considerably, my assistant, Siobhan Cruz Kelly, world's greatest executive assistant, was just describing to me before the show an incident that she had just had at the CVS where, you know, she was unable to get the help that she needed. So she's 30 or 31 or something like
that. Well, I definitely noticed that in retail situations, unless there's something wrong with
so
me
that's,
and
so that,
where
so
people just don't want to talk to me, which is quite possible, I'm like, nobody says hello or anything. Like, am I here or not here?
But,
all right, this is getting to be old man session.
No, so I don't think that it is. And, all right. And I actually think some of this is materially measurable. And the example that I'm going to use is the way people dress.
Okay.
And
flannel.
And well, Kevin Answers has a kind of a Southern California dress code, and
drives you crazy, doesn't it? You don't like it one bit.
I tolerate it, but it, you know, the work does get done. But how people dress for work is one.
Yeah.
But more importantly, how people dress for the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass among Catholics, it is unusual. In Southern California or in California, see a necktie, but I think even in Kansas City, it's unusual. But here's something that is even it seems to me more apparent. I would never go to a funeral wearing anything but a suit and a tie.
Mm. And a funeral? Yes, I know. It does surprise me when you go to a funeral.
But I see people in polo shirts or whatever. And same with a wedding. So funerals and weddings. Now, you used to wear morning suits to weddings or formal attire or, you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Joe described changes in social convention. I think that there is a measurable decline in the attention and care people give to what they wear for particular events. And it is an indication of how important that event is to them. If I'm dressed like a slob at your funeral, this is what I think of that rite.
Although, yeah, they're not
dressing like slobs. They don't know that.
I
don't know.
Yes, you do.
If you're raised in Southern California, there is an ethic of that's a really nice bowling shirt you put on For the funeral.
This is my wedding bow and shirt.
And like they, I think some of them, they really are this, not trying
these
to
are
be,
my church jeans.
Some of this, some of this is a Western thing. I mean, you see the sloppiness when it comes to church in the Midwest as well. But I was struck my first time in Phoenix. I was speaking with my wife's sister. I hope she doesn't mind me calling her out on the air like this. And she was single at the time. She'd just gotten back from a date. And her sisters asked her how it went. And she said, that the guy wore pants as a positive. And I thought the bar is extremely low.
Right.
Like if wearing pants even warrants noting,
a comment, you know, yeah, like, right.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Like, I was shocked there, but I don't think it was a generational thing. Although we are a few years apart, I think it was more just a cultural thing in terms of which part of the country we're in. So there, I mean, as you go further west, things are more casual.
Can I just interrupt here and find out, what was the alternative?
Shorts.
I think
was
shorts.
It shorty pants?
Or a
kilt?
No. Shorty
pants. A kilt?
No, I was speaking to someone else.
Pajama bottoms?
Years ago.
By the way, I know some states in the American Midwest, which will remain unnamed, where it's quite common to go outside to the retail store in your pajamas, in your flannel pajamas.
Yes, that's all true, but not on a date, hopefully. Although, you know, at the other extreme, I spoke to a priest from Rhode Island who lamented the tuxedo being treated as the height of fashion when it was basically servant's attire and you should have a proper dinner dress.
Yeah.
You know, you should have a dinner suit rather than like a tuxedo, which is what a servant wears.
I'm going to tell you this, even in Rhode Island, even out among the Astors and the whatever, that's a weird priest right there. That you were talking to a weird priest.
I'm not just saying, you've got kind of a range. You've got a range.
My and dad wore a morning suit at his wedding. Tails.
Oh, yes. That was very
with a
common.
U or no? Yeah.
What's that?
A morning or morning? Is it
M-O-R-N
or M-O-U-R-N?
Morning.
Not like you wear a funeral.
Morning suits? Yeah.
It's not morning like you're in mourning. But
okay. I just want to make sure.
Morning like the day just started.
Tails.
Morning.
Tails.
Yes.
Tails.
Good Lord. Let's take a quick break.
So obviously a lot of this is generational.
It is not. And manners are getting worse.
But
it's getting worse.
This is where I wanted to get to, though. Whatever the thing is that is good manners where you live, if you're a Christian, you should do it. Bad manners is unchristian. Jesus called us to treat others as we want to be treated. Mm-hmm. It is not optional. Your manners are not optional. And this does bother me. Christians who are just abrupt and grumpy and rude to other people. Maybe our manners are not getting worse, but I think that the point I wanted to get to it with this is essentially this, that manners are the way that you show love for your neighbor because you don't know them. If you see them in the grocery store, that's your one chance to live the gospel for that person, and you should have good manners.
You know what reinforces good manners,
what?
Si? Good liturgy.
Okay.
Don't laugh,
I thought it was going to be Appomattox.
No, I thought it was going to be a good dress. I was relieved you didn't.
It's a fact.
All right. Three good guys in flannel. Go ahead.
I think one thing we haven't even added to this conversation is you have a generation, and this is true really across all generations, but you have young people coming up who've been glued to a screen the entirety of their lives. And their interpersonal skills in many cases are just deficient.
Yeah,
they're just
that's
lacking.
True. Right.
And so quite apart from all of the good manners, it's like just the normal behavior of how to carry on a conversation and how to treat another person in a fully human way.
Stand up
there's
when you're talking to somebody.
There's often a need for, there's a need for some remedial growth in a lot of these areas that isn't attributable to just, different norms, different whatever. It's like, no. You're just underdeveloped as an adult because you were glued to technology from way too young of an age.
The sad thing is they know that they're underdeveloped, and that gives them a fear of social situations.
Yeah.
And that's
I say this as gently as I can, because I think it's a problem that it's not easy to fix for those who find themselves in that predicament.
Sounds to me like you're punching down, Joe.
Exactly.
There's a real power differential there. All right, we'll be right back. More Flannel Panel. Catholic Answers Live right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. During the break, I was asking the fellas, what does it mean to say reap the whirlwind? Because I was about to use the phrase reap the whirlwind, and I wanted to make sure I used reap the whirlwind properly. I believe,
but it's so the wind, reap the whirlwind.
What does that mean, so like the wind, though?
Like you're planting something worthless, like planting wind.
Oh.
And
oh,
and then you're
my
getting,
wife hates it
you're
when
getting
I do
worthlessness
that.
In response.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
That could be the Bible verse for
your
this
after,
show.
After the segment on manners.
Oh, my God. It just came out. I'm sorry.
Stop
so
right
sow
there.
The wind, reap the whirlwind. This is what I think we have done. I think we are about to reap the whirlwind. I think the entire planet is about to reap the whirlwind. And I want to talk about that. And I have
I feel like that's already underway.
a whirlwind that the world did not expect to be reaping. A headline in January from the New York Times, China's population falls, heralding a demographic crisis. The headline this week from Reuters, China's population drops for a second year with record low birth rates. I think that a point made in these articles that people are not adequately aware of, China has entered a period of irreversible demographic design.
Demographic and winter, they call
that
it.
It's called irreversible demographic decline. That means over the next...
Design is not inappropriate there since they caused this.
They caused the problem themselves, and we're causing the problem ourselves.
Sure.
But the Chinese will never again, unless they have massive immigration, or maybe they take over some other countries, they will never again have the population that they had before the 2020s. They will never again. That means 10 years from now, the population will be smaller than today. 20 years, it'll be smaller than 10 years from now. 40 years, it'll be smaller than 20 years from now. And the end of that is no one knows. No demographer has ever seen a country enter this kind of decline and recover from it. We do not have this experience.
This isn't exclusive to China.
But I wanted to start with China because this is about to become a global phenomenon where we will not replace ourselves. And so we will enter a permanent demographic decline, meaning for all the foreseeable decades and centuries, the human population will get smaller and smaller decade by decade.
Yeah, that is a very alarming fact, partly because at the same time you have longer and longer lifespans. So you have an aging society with fewer people to take care of those who are getting older.
Yeah, nations that have social
security. You better be nice to these rude young people.
So the nations that have social security structures are going to face economic catastrophe.
Well,
it seems like a joke. Even, you know, again, I'm 39 as of 2 days ago. The idea that I'm going to have social security seems like a laugh.
Well, I plan to use it before you get the opportunity.
Few million of your friends.
Yeah. So one of the images that demographers use to describe this situation is the inverted pyramid, or the inverted triangle. You've got the one grandchild or the one child there with two parents and four grandparents and eight sets of great grandparents, and he's the one guy that's working.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, supporting whatever that was, 12.
Right. And 10. This can't end well. Like
14.
Thank you.
there's like I actually think there are a lot of people, probably many of them listening right now, who will say, well, that's good. There's too many people. We're ruining the environment. And it'll be good to get the population down, you know, under 5 billion, and then a generation later under 2 billion, and then a generation later under a billion. People think that that's a good thing.
Yeah, so the way that this is not a complete disaster is this way. The economy will naturally become decentralized as a consequence of this, and parts of the world where fertility is celebrated and honored will have self-sustaining small economies.
But in general, self-sustaining small economies are also referred to with the word poverty. I mean, the reason that we're not poor is because we are, at least part of the reason, is because we are a massive interconnected society.
Because we have big TVs.
Well, yeah, we haven't even talked about this social dimension.
Because we have big TV sets?
No, it's not just, where do you think your food comes from? Well, you think they're growing it all out here in San Diego County?
Well, actually quite a bit of it, to tell you the truth.
I'm
just east of us in the Imperial Valley, a lot of food is grown. But no,
you don't have to go back very many generations to where people were eating the food that were the roots, the vegetables that they had collected for the winter.
Precisely, and this isn't necessarily a bad set of circumstances.
It is a bad set of circumstances. To be poorer is worse. It's a very bad set of circumstances.
Really, to be self-sustained,
the economist.
To not be able to feed your children, like to not have vegetables and fruits to feed your children, that's bad. That's a step backwards. That's not a step forwards. To go, well, we've got plenty of rutabaga in the basement, that's not progress.
I'm not certain that we've solved global famine and by centralizing food production.
It's not even a matter of centralizing food production. So Julian Simon, in his book, The Ultimate Resource, argues that the human being is the ultimate resource. And he was arguing this in the 70s against all the population bomb people, Paul Ehrlich.
Which was a lie, by the way. The population bomb is a terrible lie. And that's why we're in this
predicament. It's just idiotic.
Yeah.
And it was the cause of a lot of the current problems we're facing.
Was Simon at University of Chicago?
And Ehrlich still says he's right. He still says he's right.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a MacArthur Genius Grant. Yeah. And Simon didn't, even though Simon was right about every prediction and Ehrlich was wrong about every prediction.
In Simon's rhetoric, to refer to people as resources is there's something absolutely horrible.
That's instrumentalization.
I agree.
He was from University of Chicago.
But let Joe finish his point.
He's making the point that the Ehrlich and the like are used to doing like animal studies, and they're used to overpopulation among rats. And they have no sense that a human being might be more resourceful than a rat might. And so you have things like the Green Revolution with Norman Borlaug, where the overall capacity of the earth to feed people has increased by more than a billion people because of genetically modified organisms. So we can feed people right now today that we literally couldn't have fed 100 years ago or 50 years ago.
No,
and this is a massive positive movement that's a result of human ingenuity and any number of other positive changes. So it's not really that humans are the resource, it's that they're the resourceful. And so rather than viewing humans as just like mouths to
each
feed
burden,
that we have to...
Or as carbon footprints.
Like just a burden. Right, exactly. The solution to tomorrow's problems will be from
people.
The children born today. Yeah.
Chris?
I don't disagree with the fact that people can solve problems. But the praise for this global food production system that is dependent on genetically modified crops and animals and pesticides that have poisoned this planet, it's surprising me to be hearing it from either of you guys.
It's not just that.
Compared to starvation, I'd rather have DDT than starvation.
But it's not just that, Chris. It's that when they grow grapes in the winter in Chile, we can transport them here.
Do you have a right to grapes in the winter? This is a funny thing. This is a strange claim. I mean, I guess you can get them.
But that's trivializing. You're trivializing something that's food. Yes, you have a right to food, and higher quality, and greater plenty of food is a good. It's not an evil. Are there many evils in the food production system that we have?
I will stipulate that there's plenty, but not that the quality is greater. I think it's diminished. Look at the.
But you okay? So you didn't live in India in the 1970s. I'm sorry, but that is just outright trivializing to say the quality of food is not better. A billion people, more than a billion, nearly a billion and a half people in India are being fed because of the Green Revolution.
Are they? Are they being fed in India right now? Actually,
yes. Hunger.
I mean, starvation is demonstrably down.
They were
by quite
starving
a lot.
In India.
Mortality is way down by like every measurable rubric. This has been a positive boon. Now, sure, maybe you can't get like certain farm-to-market organic foodstuffs for 8 billion people, but those have always been kind of a privileged luxury item, you know, wherever you are. I mean, whether it's because you can't get it geographically or because you can't afford it, it's never been the case that everyone just had bougie farm-to-market free-range organic beef or whatever it was.
I think the description of bougie farm to market of what is a fundamental command in Genesis to subdue the earth, this is a vocation of man that is given to mankind before any other animal husbandry.
But I think that we're seeing that happen with things like the Green Revolution.
I don't want to dismiss what you say about pesticides or you know, big agriculture and all that. I don't want to dismiss that.
The homestead farm is going to become more common. People will begin to realize that this vast global network is on the verge of collapse, and this demographic winter is going to contribute to that, and local, more human scale food production is going to be the good thing that comes out of this.
Well, I hope that we transition to that, but to deny the good of the Green Revolution, I think, is a terrible. I mean, when I was a kid in college, 40,000 children a day died of starvation.
All right, so planet. I'm not
40,000 children a day. The population of the earth is double that now.
May
and
I
it's
go on
one
record
quarter
for saying
as
I'm
many.
Glad people are not starving?
But you didn't go on record in that. You trivialized it. This is one of the greatest goods humans have achieved is feeding the world, and we're going to lose that if we lose connection with one another because we will not follow the commandment to be fruitful and multiply.
Yeah, I think as we're talking about this, we don't want to lose sight of that's what this is ultimately about. A demographic winter is not good news for anybody, ultimately. And we haven't even talked about a lot of the geopolitical consequences. When you have the wealthy industrialized nations in a demographic winter reliant increasingly upon immigrants for labor, and then the social tensions that creates, I mean, it is destabilizing for everyone involved. In a way that is just not going to be
it's unpredictable too.
Outcome. Right.
Yeah.
And well, I in fact have predicted one outcome.
Which
and
is?
By the way, I let me go on record saying I'm against demographic winter too. But one outcome is going to be that where there are certain pockets of humanity that respect fertility, whatever
they'll flourish.
They will.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's right, and that we want there to be more of those pockets. And part of that is the reception of the gospel, certainly, where people know that it's good to be a human being. Human beings are that God himself has been one of us, and that you stop worrying about your carbon footprint or your kids' carbon footprint. You can't do anything. I mean, you can do things about that, but failing to have children is not one of the things you should do about that.
I think one thing to add to this is that we aren't just like seeing this demographic winter in our own countries. We're exporting this, you know.
Yes.
China and India were doing a lot better.
To the developing world.
What Pope Francis calls ideological colonization.
Yes.
I mean, this is another area he's been very good, very clear on, that we're exporting the same toxic ideas that are destroying the West.
In the form of hormonal contraceptives that's sewn into women's arms.
Or American foundations paying for the forced sterilization of women in Tibet and China and India. All that happened because people said we're going to have a population bomb, and now we've got the opposite of a population bomb. Well, we need more of the greatest good in this universe, which is human beings. I really enjoyed that last conversation.
I just want to encourage my brothers to go plant a tomato tomorrow.
I definitely could be better about that. Thank you, Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers.
Always a joy, Si.
Thank you, Joe Heschmeyer, president of Catholic Answers.
I'm even more happy about that.
All right. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.